welcome to this Wednesday edition of Main Street on member-supported Prairie Public. I'm Craig Blumenschein. Today's show is packed. Later, Rick Yohn joins us for Prairie Plates, and this week, he's diving into one of my favorite topics, bakeries. Plus, we'll hear a special report from Harvest Media on farm income, examining the latest trends in agriculture. But first, we're heading to the University of North Dakota, where we'll meet Jennifer Watney, an aerospace physiologist and registered nurse who leads the motion sickness desensitization program at UND's aerospace program. Her work may make you queasy at first, but the goal is to help you beat motion sickness for good. The university is now offering a 3-day course open to the public designed to help anyone struggling with motion sickness. Jennifer Watney, welcome to Main Street.
Thank you for having me.
You are in the aerospace department here at the University of North Dakota.
Correct.
And you have available a 3-day course to the public about motion sickness.
Correct.
Yeah. What is motion sickness? I think we all maybe think we've had it once in our life, but what is it?
So motion sickness is one of those things that is very commonly experienced among people, but not commonly talked about. So it's actually kind of some misinformation or a mismatch between your senses. So you have your eyes that might be seeing one thing, your ears, your inner ear, which is your vestibular system, is feeling another. And then you also have your nervous system that is sending messages and they're not lining up. So most people will experience this when they're riding in the passenger seat of a car. So generally what causes that, if you're maybe looking down at a book or your phone, you're feeling that you're moving, but your eyes are not telling you the same thing because you're not looking at the horizon. Other situations happen as a passenger because you don't have that foreknowledge of what's going to happen. You're not controlling the car. So those are big things that can lead to motion sickness in a vehicle. As far as being on a boat or maybe fair rides, again, what you're seeing and what you're feeling isn't lining up, or else it's something that you're just not used to. It's new to your body. And that's why our program is kind of unique, because we'll expose you to those things and let your body get used to it.
So you're going to make me sick before you make me better?
Is only if you want to. So yeah, that's kind of the way it works, unfortunately. So
why do some people experience motion sickness, I think, more than others?
So the highest group of people that actually experience it are younger kids. So kids, it peaks around age 6, and around age 12, it might level off or in some cases go away. So children and women have the worst cases of it, the most prevalence. So fortunately for you as a male, and as we age, it also, symptoms start to reduce in some people. But I've had some people I've spoken with, especially women, and they said it's just kind of been tough their whole life.
So I love roller coasters.
Yeah.
I've jumped out of airplanes. We've done cruises and been in the ocean, deep sea fishing. So you're saying as I get older, I probably won't have any more problems. The only problem I've ever had is circles, the tilt-a-whirl, drive
yes.
me crazy.
Those are tough because the fluid inside your ear gets spinning and your eyes are kind of telling you one thing, and those are tough. So what the motion sickness, what causes it is you get these mismatches from your eyes, your inner ear, your nervous system, and it travels up into an area of the brain that actually stimulates the nausea and vomiting. So that's kind of how it works on a physiological level.
So the University of North Dakota is concerned about this because you train pilots.
Correct.
And others. How do you desensitize, if I can say that word correctly, someone so they may not have the symptoms as much as they used to?
So when a student experiences it up in flight, their instructor is going to take over, and you know, then they'll get to they'll probably land or end the flight. So what we do is continue the exposure. And a lot of people don't get that desensitization because when you're experiencing it, you quit the activity you're doing. You know, if you get sick on a fair ride, you probably don't go on any fair rides, you know, any more fair rides that day. Or if you're sick in a car, you might pull over. So with our students, we like to put them in a safe environment where we can continue the exposure and also limit how rapidly we're exposing it to them, because some people just need to build up that tolerance, start slow, and then we gradually increase. So for our students, it's tough because a lot of these guys, you know, they've dreamed about being a pilot their whole life. So when you get in a plane and fly and you get sick every time, it can be pretty discouraging.
Is this something that always can be treated?
Not in every case. There is a small percent of the population that might just have some anatomical issues in your inner ear that will not adapt to the treatment. And I encourage people to always, if they have concerns about it, maybe seek out advice from their physician before coming to see us, just, you know, in case they're worried about safety or, you know, we want to make sure it's a safe and pleasant experience for everybody. But in most cases, like the military has found in 85% of the pilots they did this type of training with, they had success.
I've seen on TV the bands.
Yep.
Or the patches.
Yep.
Are those just good enough?
So this program, what is unique about it is it's effective, but it can also be effective in conjunction with other treatments. So the one thing that sets it aside for our aviation students is the FAA does not allow them to take medications for nausea. So that is kind of a big drawback. So that's why we go towards this more holistic approach. You know, for the general public, things like scopolamine patches have been proven to be very effective, low side effects, and they're pretty commonly used. The bands are also helpful because they do kind of hit on a pressure point that is kind of thought to alleviate some of those motion sickness symptoms. So I think they're great options.
I've always thought bands were hocus pocus.
Well, and you know, sometimes it's the placebo effect that has also been, you know, in different medication studies, they'll give one person an effective medication, one person a placebo, and they might have the same effects. So sometimes it's kind of that, you know, what you think about, you bring about kind of a thing. But some students that I've had that have done this program wear the bands and they do say they help. So, you know, whether it's hocus pocus or not, maybe if at least it brings them some symptoms.
If it works, it works.
But for the general public, I would encourage them, if there are other symptoms or other methods they have that work, to keep trying those. And then this program in conjunction with it might just kind of help take off those final symptoms to, you know, get you as comfortable as possible.
We're enjoying our conversation with Jennifer Watney, an aerospace physiologist and registered nurse. She oversees the motion sickness
desensitization
program at the University of North Dakota's aerospace program. It's a 3-day course and it's available to the public. When you say you want to continue stimulation for someone, a pilot who maybe his student pilot perhaps that's just gotten sick, comes back here, how do you do that?
So we have our simulator and I'm able to adjust the RPM rate. So initially we start off slow and if a student had just got done flying and they were still symptomatic, I would probably let them recover and rest until they were feeling better. But maybe on a different day they would come in and I'll take a brief history of, you know, kind of what's been going on with them. And if their symptoms are more severe, I'm going to start them off at a slower rate versus somebody that maybe doesn't get quite as sick. Cause I want them to be, you know, I want it to be effective, but still comfortable. So I would put the student in there and we will do the first day. They'll do 2 10-minute sessions.
What are they seeing when they're in?
So there's a couple different options for our students. We have them fly the simulator and they'll just be looking at a horizon. They can fly over the ocean if they want. And it's not too difficult to learn to fly. So I would be willing to teach like a civilian if they wanted to come in and try it. Otherwise, I can lock the screen so they just can stare at a fixed horizon with the ground and the sky, which is what's recommended, just to keep your eyes on the horizon, or I can completely shut that screen off. So just depending on what the person prefers and what might work for them. But it is recommended, like if you get sick in a car or in an airplane, that you do look at the horizon. So, and also the nice thing about flying, it might also provide a little bit of a distraction for the person inside, which kind of helps as well, kind of.
How have you found people adapt? Is it something that is just immediate? Does it really take time? Is a 3-day course long enough? Might they need to come back then 6 months later and work at it again?
So that's a good question. So with the desensitization program, it's kind of like anything else in your body, say working out, for example. Say you work out and get these big muscles and then you just quit. What's going to happen? You're going to lose that progress you made. So with motion sickness desensitization, in order to reach habituation, is what the military uses, you need continuous exposure. So I suggest to people, and for our students, it's easy because they just keep flying. You know, they're exposing themselves 3 days a week. But for someone like you who might take it, I would encourage you to ride in the passenger seat of a car. If you can go on a merry-go-round with your kids or grandkids, try that. Something that's going to get those that inner system kind of triggered, maybe a swing on a swing set, to keep exposing yourself to it. And then it's been shown that with that continued exposure, that's how people really obtain that long-term success. But our program is a really good way to get started with it.
What's the history of the program? How long has it been here?
So the history, here at UND, we just started it last spring, but the program itself has been active with the military for years. The technology has improved quite a bit. So motion sickness was really started looking into motion sickness in World War II when they were on these missions and they were going to drop their soldiers off at a mission site. And the soldiers got off the aircraft and they were so motion sick, they couldn't even continue with their duties. So, of course, this can be problematic because they're not, you know, functioning at their sharp self. So the military started looking into different profiles. And back in the day, instead of our nice fancy simulator that we have, they would put them in a chair, line the floor with plastic and just spin them, get them used to it. And it was effective, but very unpleasant for these people. So that's kind of the history of it. The military still uses that same method. However, just with the increased, or, you know, the enhanced technology that we have now with simulators with nice fans and comfortable seats.
Is it ever the case where your training plus maybe some over-the-counter medicine is the best complete solution? Or should people expect maybe to have your training and then be free from needing other things to have?
So situations will vary because, you know, everybody has different symptoms and our bodies differ on so many different levels. For some clients, so the student we have that got our program kind of started, we had this young man who had just started school here, just started flying and had a lifelong dream of being a pilot, became so ill every flight he would throw up. So, you know, we're a flight physiology, and then in the military, you know, the flight physiologists take care of the people when they're sick or having medical issues. So one of the professors reached out to my boss here and they're like, hey, you're flight physiology, like help this kid out. So we reached out to the company that we bought our trainer from, who happens to be a retired flight surgeon from the military. And he's like, hey, I have this profile here from the Air Force. Why don't we, you know, he's like, I'll break it down into something that would be easier to be used for you and your students. So we did get that profile, and it's pretty easy. It's very basic. Day one, day two, day three, he laid it out for us. And he also mentioned that, you know, even though this desensitization therapy is very effective, it is one of several facets used to, you know, completely eliminate motion sickness from people. So this young man that we had, he did well in there. He had it was, you know, it wasn't the most pleasant experience, but he was able to get the process started of desensitization. And he also did physical therapy for it, which most people don't realize that physical therapists can help with some of those inner ear issues. So a combination of doing our program and physical therapy, he now flies without any motion sickness.
A good success
yes,
story.
Yes, our first one and our most successful.
Are there different types of motion sickness, Jennifer?
So there's some different symptoms that people can have, and it really varies based on your individual susceptibility or the kind of motion you're being exposed to. If you're flying in an aerobatic airplane, you're probably going to have some more severe symptoms than a person riding in the passenger seat of a car. But the symptoms can vary from the most common, of course, is nausea and vomiting. Some people might just cold sweats, pallor, which is just paleness of your skin, headache, drowsiness. You might have a loss of appetite or increased salivation. In some more severe symptoms, there's actually a cognitive impairment that can happen known as Sopite syndrome, which can be very debilitating. It can cause some extreme drowsiness, mood swings, depression, even sleep disturbances, and it can last for quite a while.
More so than just the event.
Yep.
Or during the time you're experiencing.
It can last for hours to days afterwards. So although that is more rare, that's something the general public probably doesn't realize is a thing. So, and unfortunately, sometimes motion sickness can linger for a while after you've been through it.
I'm driving down the road. My wife's driving.
Mm-hmm.
Makes me nervous enough. Just kidding.
Yep.
But I'm in the passenger seat and I get a little bit queasy.
Mm-hmm.
Your best advice right then.
Look at the horizon. Keep your eyes fixed on the horizon. Don't look down. Also try to limit your head movements. So anytime we're in motion, we have fluid inside of our ears that kind of helps detect that motion. When you change head position and move your head back and forth, it can also disrupt that fluid. So keep your eyes nice and straight on the horizon.
Do people experience motion sickness more during the day or during night?
That's a good question. You know, I don't really know the answer for that, but just what I know from what we teach in like our visual illusion stuff, I imagine the nighttime would be a little more difficult only because sometimes you don't have a good clear reference of that horizon.
Yeah. So we've mentioned that this program is available for the wider community.
Mm-hmm.
The public can come to you.
Yep.
How do they take advantage and what are the costs?
So the cost is $400, and that includes a 3-day session. We have a very state-of-the-art full motion simulator that our aviation students use for training. And our students normally pay about $150 an hour to just use the simulator. Plus, you have, a physiologist in there with you, such as myself, and my coworkers will also start to do this program. So you have a good, educated medical person in the room with you. So, you know, a combination of those things, and we want to make it affordable for the public. But also just with the use of our simulator and stuff like that, we want to make sure that we have that covered. So the best way to get a hold of us would be, we have a aerospace physiology website, and there is a link on there that would help you get linked up, and then to be able to contact myself if you had any further questions.
If I'm going to take a trip in March, where I'm going to be maybe on a long cruise, when would be the best time? Because maybe I've had these problems in the past. Mm-hmm. You said you kind of need to kind of keep at this to get better at it.
And sure.
Taking it now help me, or should I wait until maybe February and then go right on the cruise?
I would say probably taking it a little closer to your trip might be more beneficial, just because it would be, unless you're very on the ball about keeping up with that exposure, we don't want you to have to go through the program and then lose any of that progress you made. So I would recommend closer to the trip.
There might be people who are listening who might be thinking, I don't want to have to go through this, even if it might make me better. What would you tell them?
I would tell them, so this is a program that has not been widely talked about. So, and for some people, it seems kind of scary when we tell you that we're going to put you in a simulator, shut the door and spin it. A lot of people are like, oh man, like that sounds really unpleasant.
That's the ticket to my throwing up at the carnival right there.
So the way our machine works is it's climate controlled. So we have fans we can turn on. We have a nice comfortable chair in there. You're in constant contact with me the whole time. And I walk you through it. And while you're in there, I also give you some different breathing, relaxation techniques. I can put on your favorite song, anything to help distract you, keep you comfortable while that inner ear adapts with your nervous system and your eyes to this motion.
So Jennifer, this might be appropriate for someone who even goes to the lake,
yep.
Right? They're out on the boat and their kids or grandkids are having a great time and they're maybe not quite able to enjoy things as much. They're worried that they might be getting sick or will get sick soon. This could be very helpful for them.
Correct. So a lot of people get, kind of a seasickness, and some people even get it in smaller boats. When people think seasickness, they think large ships on the ocean, but there's plenty of people who do get motion sick just in a small fishing boat. So something like this could help too, just to kind of get those, that inner ear stabilized, get it used to the motion and hopefully desensitize them to the point where they can enjoy being out with family.
Have you helped young children?
Not yet. I think we're going to have maybe an 18 plus in here but with young kids, I've talked to a lot of people, the people that I've worked with, that are still suffering from it, said they used to be the kid on the bus with the trash can next to their seat because they would throw up on the school bus. But as far as little kids, I've never even thought about that, but yeah.
Yeah. How about, is there a time that you're too old to maybe try to experience motion better?
That is a good question. That is something I've kind of been thinking of as well. Since this is all new to us, I want to make sure that we can help the biggest variety of people, but make it safe. And we don't want to make anybody's symptoms worse. So if you've got any kind of chronic dizziness or inner ear disease, like Meniere's disease is something that is somewhat common in the medical world, I don't think you would be a good candidate for it. But if you do have inner ear disease or even migraines, that does put you at increased risk for motion sickness.
So you're saying you should be in pretty good health.
That's what I'm
saying. To experience this?
I would say to be a healthy person, because the last thing I want to do is make anybody's symptoms worse. Huh. Like my dad, for example, he's got some dizziness here and there, and he's about 69. He's a young 69, but I put him in our helicopter simulator and he's like, I was fat like crap for the rest of the day. Mm-hmm. So in some situations I would definitely say, it's maybe not ideal, but, that's why I do a little bit of a screening with everybody before they do our program, just to make sure it's a good fit for them.
So Jennifer, you talked about a 3-day program. Is it an intense 3 days? Is it part of each day, 3 days, or is it 8 hours, 10 hours?
Sure.
How long is it?
So it'll be 3 days consecutively, but it does not need to be consecutive. The military recommends that, or that's what they've done just for the best outcome. But if you have a day or two in between sessions, I think it could still be very effective. So the first day you come in, and it's about an hour each day, so it's not too bad. So we do 10-minute sessions in our simulator. You take a 10-minute break, and then you go back in for 10 minutes. I keep you here until your symptoms have resolved, and then I'll let you go. And then the second and third day, we'll do 3 10-minute sessions with 10-minute breaks in between.
Can you tell that someone's about to get sick before they know they're going to get sick?
Well, I keep in touch with them about every minute. I just say, hey, how are you doing? Kind of keep asking them their symptoms. And then I have them rated out of 1 to 10. So once it starts to increase, and the way the military has it laid out, they kind of want to push you as far as you can. But if you do get sick, then it's stopped immediately. We'll give you a break and kind of try it again.
So for people who want to sign up, what should they do?
So we will have an aerospace, UND Aerospace Physiology has a website, and there will be under courses, there will be a link that you can sign up underneath, or else you can email me at jennifer.watney@und.edu.
And that's W-A-T-N-E.
Correct. Yeah.
And no tests either before or after the course.
No, I do. I will kind of chat with the individual and just, you know, make sure that you're a good fit for it. You know, make sure that there's no other contraindications to putting you in there, because we want to help you. We don't want to make any symptoms worse.
Jennifer Watney, she's an aerospace physiologist and registered nurse. She oversees the motion sickness desensitizing program at the University of North Dakota, North Dakota's aerospace program, and it's a 3-day course that's open to the public. Jennifer, it's been a pleasure.
Yes, it's been great having you.
Thanks for joining us on Main Street.
Yes, thank you.
I first became a member of Prairie Public when we moved back to North Dakota in 2007. We are members of Prairie Public because we love to listen to the diverse programming. We particularly love the Moth Radio Hour, StoryCorps, and just the different diverse perspectives. I have many driveway moments listening to Prairie Public, particularly with the Moth Radio Hour. I just can't seem to tear myself away without hearing how the story ends. And I just love the complete picture that Prairie Public paints for stories that are presented. I love the sustaining membership option of Prairie Public because it allows me to think about one less thing. I know that I'm contributing to Prairie Public every month, and it's not something I have to think about. I love knowing that my family and I are contributing to Prairie Public to help maintain the stories that you hear. I'm Erica Berg from Kindred, North Dakota, and I'm a proud sustaining member of Prairie Public.
Support all the things you love about Prairie Public by making a sustaining membership contribution. It's easy. Just go to prairiepublic.org or call 800-359-4145.
This is Bird Note. Author Ray Youngbear has a special bond with a red-winged blackbird in his backyard on the Meskwaki Nation's land in Iowa.
The red-winged blackbird is very friendly, and it's the first time that's ever happened in my life. I've asked it in Meskwaki, Gewishaban, Nawad Shabuchigan, I've got some food here, please wait. And the bird will listen, and then, you know, I'll just get the bird feed, and he takes it, and off it goes. And that's the first time in my life in 71 years that a bird has approached me that close.
But it's not the first time he's had interactions with these birds. Many years ago, when he was training his singing voice, Ray Youngbear took a kind of vocal lesson from the blackbirds.
In order to hone my skills with music, I'm a singer of native songs, and I'd go out into the field way out of nowhere and scream my lungs out, my throat out, and oftentimes the birds that I would hear in the woods with the red wings, and I would listen to them and try to imitate their singing. They have the most complicated song in the world, high pitches and low notes, and then it smooths out and it kicks up again. And I used red-winged blackbirds in my self-training of music, and they were instrumental in developing my voice to where it is today.
Learn more about Ray Youngbear's music and writing on our website, birdnote.org. I'm Ariana Rummel.
Whether you're a sustaining member, or you give annually, or you've made additional contributions to Prairie Public, we thank you. Your generous support invests directly in the programs and services you and your community enjoy and depend on. Thank you, Prairie Public members. We're humbled by your trust.
I like bagels. Have some salad. some barbecue.
Applesauce and some nice red beets.
There's the special music that reminds us that it's Wednesday and it's time to eat with our great friend, Rick Gion. Rick, how are you today?
I'm doing well, Craig. How are you?
I am doing really well. Another edition of Prairie Plates for us all here on Main Street. And perhaps this should be my favorite topic of all. We're talking about bakeries. We spoke about comfort food last week. This is comfort food on steroids, Rick. I love it.
Yeah, a lot of sweets this week. So we'll have a sweet conversation, and it will be a good one here. I have a lot to say on this topic.
What makes a bakery great in your mind, Rick? Is it the ambiance, the environment, the way you feel in the bakery? Is it the way it smells? Is it a good cake? Is it a good cookie? Is it a good donut? And even, is it a good piece of pie? Or coffee, right? Or even coffee. What makes a bakery really good in your eyes? And then I'm going to tell you what makes a bakery great in my eyes.
Yeah, all the delicious items. Obviously, the food has to be great. It has to be taste very good. I also like personality-wise, usually the baker, somebody to talk with a little bit, chit-chat and that sort of thing. But yeah, I mean, food has to be the most important thing. And if they have coffee, that's great. A lot of these places have savory items such as soup or sandwiches, lunches, that sort of thing. But I think a good bakery, just has a really good environment, friendly, warm, the smell, obviously. And yeah, that personality is important too, I think.
So my favorite bakery was in Cheyenne. It was off the beaten path. It was almost in a little residential neighborhood. I could go in there. They had maybe two or three of those real small round tables, so not a lot of seating inside.
Mm-hmm.
But they had for lunch every day, they had two things on the menu, and I always ordered one. They had mac and cheese, which I didn't order, and Sloppy Joe's. That's it. That was their lunch menu. But for some reason, their Sloppy Joe's for me were just really, really good. Again, it was off the beaten path. It smells so good in there. You're right. I got to know the people who worked there by their first names.
Yeah.
And I really, really enjoyed just going in there just to have lunch. They also had, Rick, something that I thought was unique to me. They had this Bread of the Month Club, right? So you could subscribe, so to speak. It might even have been each and every week. And you could just go in and pick out your loaf of bread, from the 20 different varieties of breads that they had available. It was just really good.
You can't really beat fresh bread, can you? I mean, it just...
We used to have one of those at-home bread maker things. We don't have it anymore. And it made our home smell good, but it wasn't the same. It just wasn't as good as you could get.
Yeah, bread makers just don't do dough justice, in my opinion. You need a certain amount of time for the yeast to develop. And that sweet flavor is the fact that the yeast isn't fully developed yet, and there's just a lot of like alcohol still left in the dough, and it's just kind of an interesting on the chemistry side what happens there, and it just needs more time to develop proof off and that sort of thing. But
almost like a fad thing, wasn't it, in maybe the late 90s, early 2000s, where everyone had their bread maker and you could find them everywhere. And I don't see them as much anymore.
No, I don't. I think people are really, after COVID or during COVID, were really into the sourdough thing. I was seeing that all over social media and I still do. And I think that's really neat.
All right. So we have a list of bakeries from all over the state, pretty much. Let's start down the list at the Brick Oven Bakery in downtown Bismarck. Rick, I've never been to the Brick Oven Bakery. Why should I go there?
Well, you should definitely go there. It's one of the best bakeries in the state of North Dakota. They make croissant-style, Danish-style pastries, fruit-filled, cream-filled, those sorts of things. They're absolutely delicious. And yes, the coffee there is really good. And I would go early because they sell out of a lot of select pastries. They also do croissant breakfast sandwiches, which are really, really good. Egg, bacon, cheese, that sort of thing. This place is busy all the time. They sell out of certain items. I'm kind of telling everyone a secret. Well, maybe in Bismarck, they already know. But yeah, Brick Oven Bakery, definitely a destination in North Dakota as far as bakeries are concerned. Another one in Bismarck that I really enjoy is more of a donut place, but it's Bearskat Bakehouse in Bismarck. And they just had, instead of a political election, they had a donut election.
Nice. I like that.
So maple the Maple Long Johns won. And so I think they've been 50 cents lately or something like that. That's a heck of a deal. I'd probably go buy a dozen today if Bearscat Bakery was in downtown Fargo here next to Prairie Public. But yeah, kind of fun. They do a lot of fun stuff. And I learned that cowboys call donuts Bearscat, or did call them Bearscat or something. So that's where that comes from.
Now, I have to tell you, Rick, I saw this on your list earlier today when you emailed it to me. So I wrote a limerick about Maple Long Johns. Do you want to hear it?
I do.
All right. Here we go. There once was a Maple Long John, golden brown in the light of dawn. With its glaze rich and sweet, it was quite the treat, and was gone in a blink, not withdrawn. How's that?
Very creative. I'll put it that way.
All right. Thanks for the vote of confidence, Rick. Let's move on.
You're more creative than I am, and that's good.
Where else can we go?
We can go moving east here to the Tower City Travel Center, which is a hot spot. It's been a well-known stop for bars, cookies, and pie for decades now. And that place sells out a lot of items, too. Just kind of a well-known spot. Closer in the east here, up in the Grand Forks area, I'd definitely check out Mollier's place, Bernie's, cookies, pastries, breads, that sort of thing. She just does things the right way, and it's really well done. It's just delicious stuff. In downtown Fargo here is Nicole's Fine Pastry and Cafe. They just got a James Beard's semi-finalist award last year. I was there on Saturday getting a pistachio croissant and a cup of coffee. Super good. Just consistently good, high-quality stuff. Another place close to the Prairie Public Studio here is Moonrise Cafe, and they do cakes very well. They also do a lot of cookies and other pastries, breakfast Pop-Tart, homemade Pop-Tarts with puff pastry, guava fillings, really unique flavors there, and just kind of a neat little place that also serves really good coffee. And then down the way from that, of course, is Sandy's Donuts, which is famous here in the eastern part of the state. You really can't beat their old-fashioned sour cream donuts, in my opinion. And yes, they do have Maple Long John, so that's a place for you to go, Craig.
I love it. I would love it. You bet.
In South Fargo, I'd check out Kay's. That's some old-fashioned pies, bars, cookies, that sort of thing. They also have a lot of good soups, sandwiches, that sort of thing. Jen's Bakery in way South Fargo, I've been seeing them gear up for Christmas and posting, hey, if you need a Christmas cookie collection, call us. So that's been kind of neat.
Remember Jen's Bakery? It won my beer cheese soup award so far. We've looked all over the place to duplicate this place called the Breadboard in Riverton, Wyoming, and they come the closest so far.
I am going to write a note on that because I forgot about that. And next time I go down there, thank you for the recommendation. Usually I'm the one that's giving those out. So that's really good. Another good place, and these cakes are really unique. She does things the right way. They're a lot of fun, is Sonder Bakehouse in Southwest Fargo. It's kind of hidden in this newer development. And she does these macaron cookies that are just absolutely delicious. She does a lot of stuff the right way. And you can get a lot of creative cakes. If you want a really creative birthday cake, call Sonder Bakehouse in Southwest Fargo. And it's really a neat location. And then for gluten-free, there's a location in South Fargo called Mel's Bakery. And honestly, I've had stuff numerous times from Mel's Bakery. I cannot tell the difference. Have you had gluten-free baked goods, Craig, that I can't tell the difference most of the time?
Yeah. So my sister-in-law has to really watch what she eats for a lot of reasons, and she needs to be gluten-free. So when we get to go to her house in Sheridan, Wyoming, we eat gluten-free, and you're right. You can't tell the difference oftentimes.
No, so Mel's Bakery in South Fargo, go check that out. Over across the Red River in Moorhead is Black Cat Bakery, and they do a lot of fun stuff too, pies, cookies, bars, and that sort of thing. I will add that for pastries, I prefer European-style pastries, and I'm a quarter Italian, and I know that seems a little unique in North Dakota, but I do like cannoli, which are Italian pastries, sfogliatella, which is always fun to say, or They're similar to these lobster tail type pastries. They're basically a filled Danish that have a certain shape to them. And then cannolis are for Norwegians, kind of like filled krumkaka, if you've had krumkaka, which most people have, I think. So
I used to travel quite a bit in Wyoming, as you can imagine. And so I would stop at the donut shop, and it's a chain. You see them around, at least you see them around Wyoming. But a couple things. One, I always admired its owner, the guy by the name of Dick Phillip, who had to get up, what, at 2:30, 3 a.m. every single morning. And by the time I came by at 5:30, there he was, you know, with good stuff, just ready to go. And I was so thankful that he was willing to do that until he retired. Really good. My kids will tell you the best donuts in their mind is from the donut shop in Riverton, Wyoming. Although it's different now. It's not like it used to be. A lot of things change, Rick, even donuts.
Well, you'll find that a lot of these bakers and donut shops, they're extremely dedicated to their career. They stick around for decades, and they really establish a well-known business that does great. And so it's really neat to see.
All right, so we do a trivia question with Matt O'Lean for Oscar Trivia. I'll end this edition of Prairie Plates by asking you a question, Rick. You can go to any of these bakeries, any of these places you've talked about, and order just one item. Where are you going, and what are you going to order?
Well, I'm going to go to a non-bakery, which is not too far away from here, Spaghetti Western, and order a cannoli, because they make really good cannolis, and it's only a few blocks away. But it's a really good Italian place just down the road here.
I would never have guessed Spaghetti Western. We haven't been there yet. We plan to go. Offers cannolis. Rick Guillon, he joins us each and every Wednesday for Prairie Plates. Rick, thank you so much.
Good to be with you again, Craig.
Listening to Prairie Public right now, so I bet you're a bit of a news junkie, right? But do you also like music? Well, I bet you do. Prairie Public is the place for that too. Did you know that we have a guy named Mike Olson who spins adult album alternative music during the week?
There goes the last DJ who plays what he wants to play.
He's got an endless library, limitless musical knowledge, and a clever way of handcrafting sets of songs. You can listen to Prairie Public's Roots Rock and Jazz stream on an app or a smart speaker pretty much anywhere, and on an HD radio anywhere in the region. Check out Mike Olson on Prairie Public weekdays from 9 a.m. to 10 and noon to 6 p.m. Support for Prairie Public is provided by the John and Elaine Andrist Charitable Trust, supporting the communities of Northwest North Dakota. Information at nwndcommunityfoundation.org.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Craig Blumenschein. If you're thinking about agriculture, you may have an image of a farmer on their tractor or with a bucket feeding livestock. The reality is farmers can often be found in office cubicles, driving school buses, or stocking shelves. That's become much more common in the last 50 years. Today, more than 85% of farm families rely on off-farm income. As Harvest Public Media contributor Teresa Holmesey reports, that's because farmers often need another part-time job or even a full-time job to stay in business.
The Leelanau Peninsula, known as Michigan's Pinky, extends for 30 miles into Lake Michigan. The rolling hills and lake's insulating effect makes this place ideal for growing fruit. Cherry farmer Phil Halstead says the landscape never gets old. But growing cherries is becoming more difficult.
I don't go to Vegas because I gamble every year. Cherries are so, so risky.
After several tough years, Halstead has transitioned his farm to a UPIC model, where people pay to harvest their own cherries. He also plans to cash in on the region's tourist economy by opening campsites on his land. Halstead says his family made those changes after years of working part-time jobs and still struggling to make ends meet.
2 years ago, I was ready to throw in the towel, and my wife said, I'm not. And I love my wife, and I follow my wife. And so it was like, okay, I got to figure this out. So together, we're trying this new business model.
Only 37% of farmers held a primary job off the farm in 1974. Today, roughly 85% of family farmers rely on other jobs to support their livelihoods. U.S. Secretary of Agriculture Tom Vilsack says the increasing dependence on off-farm income is causing more and more small farms to sell.
So the question I think we ask ourselves is simply, why is it that the farm family has to work multiple jobs? Why can't the farm work harder and generate more farm income?
Profit margins are thinner for small farmers. The cost of inputs like seed, fertilizer, and labor have generally gone up, while prices for ag products are lower. Agricultural economist Daniel Munch with the American Farm Bureau says competing in a global market means farmers have to keep scaling up.
We're never in the position of saying it's bad that farms are getting bigger, right? They're just doing it because that's what they need to survive in the marketplace we have now, which is a harsh reality.
In Nebraska, Vern Jansen grows corn and soybeans and sells to a local co-op. He says the good news is that he's debt-free, but he likely won't break even from his crops this year.
With an average yield and a below average price, it doesn't pencil out.
Jansen is also a substitute bus driver. While initially it wasn't for the extra income, now he says he's glad to have the job. He says farming is like college football in Nebraska.
We have had a terrible time for many, many years. But the thing that keeps us going as football fans is there's always next year. And that's, I think, what keeps a lot of farmers going. There's always next year.
While farmers are used to the ups and downs, some are exploring ways to generate more income from their goods. That could help small and mid-sized farmers diversify and survive, says Jay Arbuckle, an Iowa State University sociologist.
You know, differentiating, adding value to a product is a way to earn a price premium. Berries turn them into jam, or pigs turn them into ham. Adding a second or third crop that has more local market or a more niche market.
Or if it's an option, farmers can turn to agritourism, like Phil Halstead in Michigan. He points to an area where visitors will soon be able to set up campsites.
So we have a platform overlooking down below.
Even if cherries don't pay, Halstead says he doesn't want to see local orchards sliced up and turned into subdivisions.
Once that house goes up, it's gone. It will always be housing. We're trying to avoid that. We love this land, and the land is special.
Halstead says in order to preserve farmland, we need to ensure farmers can stay in business. For Harvest Public Media, I'm Teresa Holmesy.
Harvest Public Media is a collaboration of public media newsrooms in the Midwest and Great Plains, including here at Prairie Public. More Main Streets ahead. Stay with us.
Did you know that when you support Prairie Public's radio service starting as little as $5 a month, you'll receive access to one of our best Prairie Public member benefits, PBS Passport. Passport lets you stream your favorite PBS shows on your Roku, Fire Stick, Apple TV, or Smart TV. Watch the programs you love all on your own time. Unlock entire seasons of programs early and discover new TV series, movies, and musical performances, all available to you when you support Prairie Public, your local NPR and PBS station.
Arts programming on Prairie Public is supported in part by the North Dakota Council on the Arts, a state agency developing, promoting, and supporting the arts in North Dakota.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Craig Blumenschein. In this episode of Natural North Dakota, Chuck Lura explores the unique beauty of larch trees, a deciduous conifer that turns golden and sheds its needles each fall, showcasing a lesser-known side of North Dakota's natural landscape.
CBS Sunday Morning aired a story a couple weeks ago on people searching out larch trees in the western mountains during the fall to observe their golden-colored needles. Although there are no larch native to North Dakota, an introduced species is grown as an ornamental in the state, and with the exception of South Dakota, a larch or tamarack is native to all states and provinces adjacent to North Dakota. Members of the genus Larix, commonly known as larch or tamarack, are rather unique in that they are deciduous conifers. Most people think of conifers as evergreens, but there are a few exceptions, and this group is one of them. The needles of these species are produced in dense clusters of 20 to 50 needles, a half to 2 inches long on short shoots. They turn a golden yellow during the fall, before dropping. As you might expect during the winter months, they look like dead evergreen trees. American larcher tamarack, Larix laricina, is a common species in the north woods of Minnesota and much of Canada, particularly in wet and boggy areas. If you see a conifer growing in a bog in northern Minnesota, the odds are that it's either tamarack or black spruce. Sigurd Olsen, renowned naturalist, author, and person instrumental in getting the Boundary Waters Canoe Area Wilderness established, wrote about the fall color of tamarack in his book The Singing Wilderness, and I quote, "The leaves are gone from the hillsides, and the glory of the red maple and of the yellow aspen and birch is strewn upon the ground. Only in the protected swamps is there any color, the smoky gold of the tamaracks. These are days of quietly falling needles, where after each breath of wind, the air is smoky with their drift," end quote. If you've observed a conifer that sheds its needles each fall in North Dakota, it's probably Siberian larch, an introduced ornamental. I've seen larch along the blacktop just north of Towner, on North Dakota Forest Service land in Turtle Mountain, and at the Denby Experimental Forest. No doubt larch are in other places as well. Some people that are unaware that larch is a deciduous conifer may assume that the tree is dying when in the fall the needles all turn yellow and drop. As a result, healthy tamarack trees are occasionally cut down. Please keep that in mind if you see all the needles turning yellow and dropping on a seemingly healthy evergreen in the fall. I'm Chuck Lara.
This is Dakota Datebook for November 13th. The Vietnam War was a polarizing and traumatic event in American history. Should we stand strong against the spread of communism, or should we allow others to chart their own course? While many Americans signed up to serve in the United States Armed Forces, other Americans marched in the streets to protest the war. When the war came to an unsatisfying end, many Americans wanted to forget about it and return to what was considered normal. For some, it was harder to forget. About 15,000 North Dakotans served during the war, and 15,000 families waited anxiously for their loved ones to return. There was an empty chair at 15,000 dinner tables. At 198 of those tables, the empty chair would never be filled, as those North Dakotans never came home. On this date, in 1982, it was finally time to come to terms with the war as the Vietnam Memorial was dedicated in Washington, D.C. The unconventional memorial is not a heroic statue. On the day it was dedicated, it was engraved with 57,939 names. 198 of those names are North Dakotans. The names are not listed in alphabetical order, but by the date the service member was killed. There are no ranks, recognizing that no one's sacrifice was greater than another's. Over the years, the number of names has grown as authorities have learned the fate of more service members. As of 2021, there are 58,281 names on the wall. Lee Allen, the spokesman for the Vietnam Veterans Memorial Fund, said, "These were mostly very young men who had hopes and dreams and lives that they left. We see them right now as a list of names, and we need to look beyond the name and scratch the surface and take a look at who they were. The individuals whose names are on the wall were ordinary Americans who answered their country's call and never came home. They left their hopes and dreams behind, along with an empty chair at the dinner table." Today's Dakota Datebook, written by Dr. Carol Butcher. I'm Ann Olquist.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from Humanities North Dakota.
President-elect Trump has promised to cut requirements and incentives for car companies making electric vehicles. What happens to automakers that have already made big bets on EVs?
Some companies might not make it across the line if some of these incentives and regulations change to the degree that we're hearing that they might.
We'll look at what Trump's stance on electric vehicles could mean for the auto industry's plans tomorrow on Morning Edition from NPR News.
Starting at 4 a.m. Central, right here on Prairie Public.
And that's a wrap for today's Main Street here on Prairie Public. Thank you for spending time with us. Remember, you can catch this and all past episodes of Main Street at our website at prairiepublic.org or wherever you find your favorite podcasts. Join us again tomorrow as we return to Grand Forks, where we'll focus on National Hunger and Homelessness Awareness Week, which runs from November 17th through the 23rd. We'll explore the challenges of homelessness in Grand Forks and hear from community leaders about the efforts underway to provide support and solutions. That's tomorrow here on Main Street, and we hope you'll join us.